seguir su
Welcome to Watch Night. Tonight we're taking a little breather from our paranormal activity saga. And we've watched The Weatherman. We've happened to flown in a special guest all the way from Chicago. Aaron, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Aaron.
Yeah, and you're an expert on everything Chicago, would you say?
More or less. Mm-hmm. I lived there for a pretty good portion of my life. When you told me that you'd be doing this movie last night, I bought a ticket last night and flew to New Orleans actually.
Immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had to get a subject matter expert. Thanks for everyone who's donating to our Patreon. That's what paid for the plane ticket.
Yeah, that paid for the plane ticket.
Yeah. Sure do appreciate it. Yeah.
Okay, so again, this is what are we calling this segment? This is the
Never Been Seen.
I've still never seen the palate cleanser, whatever.
So we're taking a little break from paranormal activity and watching The Weatherman. So this one was made in 2005. Starring Nicolas Cage, aka Nicolas Coppola, directed by Gore Verbinski. Does anybody know
Gore
Verbinski?
I do, but I can't remember the other movies he did. Like, that was a name that I recognized then and recognize now, but I don't know what else he's made.
So
didn't he invent the internet?
No. Yes.
Al Gore.
That's Verbinski Gore.
Thank you, Aaron.
Verbinski Gore. Well, he started his career making No Effects videos and Bad Religion videos.
Oh, really?
Yeah, one of his first things was that he did the video for S&M Airlines for No Effects, which is I haven't seen the video, but I'm sure it's like really terrible because that's one of their first. Mm-hmm. And he did like basically Bad Religion's like hit videos, American Jesus, 21st Century Digital Boy. Stranger Than Fiction. But then he went into filmmaking. He did a movie called The Mexican, which some people watched. It was like Julia Roberts and Brad Pitt or something like that.
Yeah,
I don't know that.
Okay. I vaguely remember
was Benicio Del Toro in that?
It's got to be from music videos.
Yeah. No, the reason that you know is his name. His claim to fame are the Pirates of the Caribbean movies.
Oh. I didn't know that. I had no idea who was responsible for this.
Right before this, he did the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie, which I don't know if you remember, but that was I think that changed like the course of filmmaking somehow. Everyone was like,
"Well, it was a smash hit."
Yeah, it was a smash hit. Before people were like,
"Swashbuckle,
how can you make a movie out of a Disney ride? That sounds stupid." And then everyone saw it and they were like, "Oh my god, Johnny Depp is amazing and they're swashbuckling." And like,
well, people like pirates, like they like cowboys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And this is basically the same movie we watched today.
Yeah,
it is. Pirates of the Caribbean and The Weatherman are probably in the same trilogy.
I just can't even believe that they were conceived by the same person.
No, it doesn't make any
realized
sense.
By the same person.
It's pretty pretty funny. Other movies he did. The way he built his reputation sort of is. He did The Ring, the American Ring.
Really?
Yeah. So, if you look at this movie, you can sort of see the same color palette as The Ring. But also, I think that, I don't know, that's kind of not that it's a fluke. The American Ring was, like, entertaining. And that was a huge deal for, like, as far as horror goes. But then his big break was Pirates of the Caribbean. He also did the Lone Ranger movie, which I know you mentioned that earlier.
Yeah, we were just talking earlier about the Lone Ranger TV show from whatever that was, like the 1912s or whatever.
Yeah, what, the beginning of television.
Yeah, yeah. Before, yeah.
And then, which I haven't seen that movie. I had really no...
It's also Johnny Depp.
Yeah, that's Johnny Depp. But that
He was Tonto.
Yeah. Wait. Yeah.
Was he?
Was he?
I don't remember.
Yeah, he played Tonto.
Who played the Lone Ranger?
I don't know. Probably...
Joaquin Phoenix, probably.
Probably. Yeah.
I think... Yeah, I don't know.
Luke Wilson.
Yeah.
One of the Wilsons.
And then he did The Cure for Wellness, which was actually like a... That's another smaller movie that he did. That's sort of a weird horror movie.
Did that win something, like an award of some sort?
It could have. I don't know. But that's another one that has like this sort of color palette. So like, I feel like this is like sort of the same thing with.
Do you know anything about like his influences? Because it kind of reminded me of, like the color palette kind of reminded me of some like. Japanese horror movies.
Yeah, I mean...
Like Survive Style 5 and...
Oh, okay.
No.
Audition. Yeah, are you kidding me?
Disagree.
Why?
I just feel like... We're already starting in.
No, I'm sorry. Okay, I shouldn't do that.
No, you can.
No, then I'd like to hear why.
Those movies were more like heavily saturated in color. Almost more like... Hold on.
She's just putting on her headphones.
Yeah, I feel like...
Because she got up
at least
from the
Survive
podcast
Style 5
as
was
started.
Like so like heavily saturated in color. If anything, just because this was like Chicago at wintertime, it was more muted and kind of dim.
Monochromatic,
yeah.
But I felt like a lot of the scenes in The Weatherman, the color palette was distinct depending on what was happening.
I noticed the color palette more on the exterior scenes, and I was thinking about this as we were watching the movie. To me, it seems like maybe just a stabilizer, because as you're filming outdoors in the winter in Chicago, you're going to get days that are sunnier or days that are more overcast, and the filter was just a way to kind of balance everything and make it look like it was consistent.
You could
see in different scenes. Sometimes there would be grass showing through the snow. Other days,
right?
Other scenes,
yeah, there was a lot of different weather
of
in this weather movie.
And yeah,
it all seemed icy.
Well, you know, it's
frigid
wind
to me.
Just that's blows
the,
everywhere.
That's the
blows all over the place.
That's the mood they wanted was icy.
Right. So and all of those kind of in between scenes you're talking about too. There was like a lot of the ice kind of moving in the like Lake Michigan and which kind of matches the concrete and everything too.
Frozen family and their inability to express their emotions to one another.
Well, the interior scenes though, like in their homes, were very warm and
that's
cozy
true.
Fireplace
yeah, they were, yeah.
kind of like.
I mean, I'm guessing that's pretty. That's probably all of his. From the stuff that I've seen other than Pirates of Caribbean, because honestly, if
that's
you do watch it, you're just not going to...
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to think about that while I'm watching Pirates of the Caribbean.
No.
But
no.
like
no.
the other things that I've seen of his, it seems like he's a pretty purposeful in like his shooting and stuff like that, especially this one. Like I've seen this movie a bunch of times, and the first time I saw it, it was just a fluke. So like, yeah, I sort of noticed like the different color palettes and stuff like that. So he seems like he did. I think he went to UCLA, so he's like a film student or whatever. But you really can't find. So as far as his influences and stuff go, you can't really find anything about that. He doesn't talk about it. I chalk that up to like the reason that he did NoFX and Bad Religion videos is because he was like while he was in film school, he's just like in punk bands and stuff like that, and he sort of turned that into like a career. So I'm sure. And then I looked at, like, pictures, like, while I was researching a little bit of this, I looked at pictures of, like, him and his, like, wife and stuff like that, and they just seem like normal people who are just, like, he and his wife do not look like they are people who are behind, like, a movie that made, like, a billion, like, the Pirates of the Caribbean movies made, like, over $1 billion.
Well, yeah,
it's fascinating because when you mentioned the music videos and you said obviously it was this you know, a student or a recent graduate mm-hmm. trying to get their name out there, you're going to take whatever work you can find.
Yeah. Right.
Weatherman was filmed, was that before Pirates?
After, actually.
After the first one.
Okay. Huh.
Yeah, after yeah.
That's, so, I mean, it just seems, sorry for the pun, but it seems like kind of unbelievable that they would give the helm over to somebody who maybe hadn't had a lot of blockbuster movies before.
Yeah,
and to follow
agree.
It up, I guess, the stark contrast between that and this kind true. Of more yeah. indie feeling well, movie. Yeah.
Was Pirates of the Caribbean supposed to succeed? I mean,
yeah.
it was a movie.
Yeah, it's a Disney yes. movie. It was a Disney movie.
It was a movie made about a ride.
But Disney doesn't. Yeah. Disney doesn't.
They were aiming for the stars, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Disney.
Yeah,
I, mean,
yeah, I guess
Johnny
it was Johnny Depp.
This is like a use of Orlando Bloom immediately after like Lord of the Rings.
Oh, I forgot Orlando Bloom was
yeah,
in that.
Yeah, I forget the timeline.
And Keira Knightley immediately
sometimes.
After
oh,
whatever
I forgot
Keira
Knightley was
up to.
In that.
Something about.
I've never seen the movie, but I know who's in it.
You've never seen Pirates of the Caribbean? I mean, it's, you know,
it's
you don't
the,
need to.
I don't need to. No,
I mean,
I get the idea.
I'll say
he's a pirate.
I watch a lot of kids, so I've seen a lot of everything like that.
I will say that the first one is like,
that
it's
sounds a little creepy.
Really
can you
fun.
Elaborate?
I babysit.
Okay, that's better than I watch a lot of kids.
Whatever.
I think we understood.
Thank you.
What were you saying?
Well, in the context of having just seen this movie.
Well, we're going to have to get to that.
Yeah. No, I was just saying, like, I don't remember. Something about him doing... I think that one was shooting for the start. Like, Pirates of the Caribbean was also a Jerry Bruckheimer film.
Okay. Right,
so
right.
That,
they
like,
around.
So, and I'm guessing... So, and then before this, he did The Ring, which was probably...
The Ring was a blockbuster.
Okay,
yeah. It was. That's what put... If I'm not mistaken, that's what put... Japanese horror onto the
yeah
American
yeah
so. I think
and that makes sense.
It was The Ring first, and then they did like The Curse.
Music
and, yeah.
The they did The Grudge.
The Grudge. Sorry, but
yeah,
The Ring
after
was
that.
Before The Grudge.
Yeah, the Ring
yeah,
was
yeah.
First.
No, but
the Ring was
I don't
first.
Think they ever would have made The Grudge.
Oh,
if,
sure.
Or The American Grudge or
no.
whatever.
Yeah,
I'm guessing that this movie is like his.
What was the Japanese name? Ju-on.
Yeah,
Ju-on.
What The Grudge?
Yeah.
Yeah, Ju-on in
this movie is kind of like his breather.
Yeah, it really is. That's what I was
saying,
or thinking is just like this is like okay, I made you a whole bunch of money. Can I have some money to do this movie? Like this one cost it cost $22 million, which is a lot of money.
Yeah,
but like not as far as movies go.
Right,
and this is also the cheapest movie that he's ever. Directed.
Okay.
So,
and it wasn't like this is actually kind of one of the periods when like Nick Cage was like on top of his game.
What
like,
else was Nick Cage doing in 2005? Does anybody
well,
remember?
He did like Face Off in what like 1998, and then he had a good run for a little bit.
I don't.
Where did
8mm was?
I love that movie. I don't know
that's
if that
movie.
Yeah, I don't know if that one.
I've never seen 8mm.
I always forget that that's Nick Cage.
Yes, that's another very quotable movie. I'm sure you didn't kill them. Now.
Anything he's in is generally pretty quotable. This one's very quotable.
This film definitely, to me, it
adaptation.
Seems like oh, adaptation.
Oh
fantastic.
Yeah, adaptation was mm-hmm. a bit. Yeah.
Where did
Matchstick Men?
What were you saying about?
Where did Ghost Rider fall?
That was like kind of as timeline. He was falling off.
Yeah,
no, but was this before?
I think
this
was
is after this.
This
movie.
Yeah.
When did he buy the Lorelei Mansion?
That was a. I think that was a while ago.
It was after Katrina, life. Though.
The yeah.
Which incidentally occurred the year that this movie came out. Big
Weatherman.
Year for weather. Big yeah. year for weather.
Yeah.
Wait, Aaron, do you know the story of Nick Cage buying the haunted mansion down here and then going bankrupt?
Or the pyramid.
I know
or
the pyramid. You know. I learned about that.
Yeah, we went to that cemetery tour together. Mm-hmm. One of the, yeah, that's right. Well, yeah.
He likes this place.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he's into... I mean, he's like an... He's a Coppola, so he's
yeah.
like a little...
He likes weird
eccentric
shit.
Man who, you know, has an interesting career. He buys really. Have you any of you seen the trailer at all for what is it, unfathomable weight of staggering genius or whatever?
No.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, it's The Unfathomable Weight of Staggering Genius.
Yeah, it's a movie where Nicolas Cage plays himself.
Yeah, kind of like Jean-Claude Van Damme and JCVD.
And, mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's about him like going to someone's private island to earn $1 million so he can pay his like $600,000 hotel bill that he's run up.
That's, oh my God.
That's about a metaphor for his career.
Yeah, yeah.
From what I understand.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because is it recently he's kind of come forward and said, actually, the reason I've taken some of these roles is bills to pay too. Right.
I think we all knew that.
Care of.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like,
Ghost Rider.
Like, when you see a movie like The Weatherman, though, which I've seen many times, actually, you really do see, a much deeper version of Nicolas Cage. And, you know, talking about the director again, whose name I wouldn't be able to probably pronounce without reading it.
Yeah. Gore Vidal.
Gore Vidal.
Yes.
No,
I almost had it.
Following up with these big blockbusters, this seems like more of a personal project.
I see that.
I think there's a lot of themes that come out that seem very personal about family. And
before we go any further, Amanda, would you like to give us a quick little rundown on what this movie is about?
Oh gosh, what is this movie about? Generally, this is a movie about the weatherman in Chicago, Dave Spritz. He changed his name from Spritzel because, you know, it would add some zing to his career as a TV weathercaster. And it's essentially about watching him at a difficult time in his life. His dad has cancer. He's dying. He's divorced or in the process of divorcing his wife. His kids are aimless, unhappy teenagers, and it's kind of just... And he's trying to get a better job as what's the equivalent of the Today Show in this universe, which is like Good Morning America or something.
It's Hello America.
Hello America, yeah.
All right, that's
good, yeah.
So it's essentially like, I guess, watching him at this time in his life as he's... becomes more and more scattered, but also seems to realize that he was always scattered. And it's all rooted in his relationship with his father, his relationship with his kids, and everybody's inability to communicate with one another at all about their feelings.
Yeah.
And then everybody just kind of passive aggressively hurting each other by accident and intentionally a lot.
Well said.
It's very much a dark comedy. This is like if someone were to say, what's a dark comedy? You could show them this movie.
Yeah. Just watch The Weatherman.
And they'd be like, I don't know if I like that. I was like, exactly.
Yeah, that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
It's frosty.
Like, this is interesting. I looked up, I think, like... whichever one's still alive of Siskel and Ebert, like their review of it. And it's, he kind of sums it up in that Dave's problem is that he is never able to find the right note, the appropriate gesture and correct behavior, try as he does.
Yep.
Perhaps he tries too hard. And he does several times in this movie.
It's the opposite of the Midas touch. Everything he touches somehow spoils.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, despite being
aware of it though,
he's aware of being successful.
Yeah.
Well, he's aware of it, but all of it does stem, like, you know, we see all these cutting interactions with his father, who's a famous author, like, you know, won the book award and, like, the Pulitzer Prize. Like, he's a famous author. Like, everybody in the world knows him, and then he has to follow this up, I guess, essentially.
He can never seem to impress him.
Right, and that's what he feels about it. And his dad also, you know...
His dad's a son of a bitch.
Yeah, you know, for all his artistic merit, can clearly not communicate with loved ones.
I do think that there's like, again, I've seen this movie like way too many times, but I do think that like there's something hidden there that you're supposed to take out of it is that, like he does
his
say
dad
that
means
his,
well too.
His dad means well, just like he does.
Right. His dad, Michael Caine.
But also you don't know his father's character. You don't know Michael Caine's character at all before he's diagnosed with lymphoma.
Actually, of this movie is entire, like, so inside. I mean, it's just from beginning to end, 100%. You are only seeing, you know, Nick's perspective. It is, I mean, Dave's perspective. You are 100%, this is 100% Dave experiencing the outside world, because you don't ever see the motivations of the other characters and, you know, any history or thoughts.
Yeah, you get weird little glimpses.
This is literally about the weatherman.
Yeah, you get weird little glimpses,
but it's also his
through the perspective of Dave Spritz. Right. Like that scene where he runs into his dad leaving his estranged wife's or possibly ex-wife's house because there's like a crisis with one of the children.
There's a couple of crises. Well, and not, so, yeah, the children are having problems. And they're
Dave's reaction to it is like, basically like, what the fuck are you doing talking to my like estranged wife? Like, you're my dad. Like, what? But so it almost paints his dad yet again in like kind of a bad light, but he's doing it because he's concerned. He overheard something about a camel toe.
But also it's another one of those like cut-ins from his dad, you know, like the entire implication is that he's doing Dave's job again.
No.
But is it
or
though?
He doesn't or is see that, him as responsible enough to take care of the situation.
Dave of stuff, there's always this undertone of like, Dave should have known this if he was genuinely an interested father.
That's his tone throughout the movie.
Yeah, that's Michael Caine's tone.
Do we feel that way because we're getting it from Dave's perspective?
I don't know. That's what's confusing.
I do think that this movie does. I can't think of another movie off the top of my head, but it does do a good, really good job of telling the story from the weatherman story, so Nicolas Cage, Dave Spritz's story, and makes like use of the unreliable narrator. So I think it does a really good job of making you it like captures you pretty early in the movie, makes you sympathize with this character, and then makes you see all of the characters through his eyes. Mm-hmm. Whereas like the reason I say, because I've seen the movie so many times, like I've watched it before and been like, well, actually, you know, he's preoccupied. When he's at the house, he's just like talking to Dave's wife because he's concerned about Shelley. Like, I don't think that there's any like anything negative about it. I think he's just like an old school. He's also like a Pulitzer Prize winning like author. So he's a Brit. He's like, so Dave is like obviously first generation American. So there's some, there's like a, I feel like there's like, there's like strangely like a lot of layers that are like put into these characters. Like everything that I read about why this movie got made, which there isn't very much, but like the people were just like, we read this script. It was like one of the best scripts that we've ever read, you know. It was just like, it was an amazing script.
Who wrote it? Did we say?
This guy, Conrad. So he...
Like Cher or Prince? Just the one name.
I think it was like
Joseph Conrad. He wrote this 120 years ago.
Heart of Darkness, the Weatherman movie. Steve Conrad. So like, yeah, this his movies are mostly, he does comedy dramas for the most part. Like he did The Pursuit of Happiness. That was a good movie.
That was kind of a
that's
drama.
That's the non-comedy drama that he did. But he did The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which that's like Stiller.
Yeah, that was Ben Stiller trying to be an actor.
I know it exists.
Yeah.
I have no interest in seeing Ben Stiller not be funny. I mean, I think he's funny.
Yeah, if I wanted
he's been
to
directing
see
this really fantastic show on Apple.
Oh, we're watching that.
We're watching that. It is real good.
I just got to the season finale and like, damn it.
I know, Severance. Isn't it ridiculous?
I haven't been tuning in weekly to a show until I saw this show.
What is it?
Severance.
It's real good.
It's like Black Mirror. Okay. It's like a Black Mirror episode. Like
we don't have Apple.
It's like
anything.
It's like Apple's really suddenly figuring out how to make
it,
a good
show.
Worry.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually wanted to blow off that show like after the first episode because I saw Ben Stiller was the director and I was like, that's bullshit. And then I was like, but it's a good
show. I thought the same thing and I thought, well, maybe it's one of those shows where they rotate the director every week.
Sure.
And now he's been there consistently.
Yeah.
I think Ben Stiller's inherently a bad writer. I just think, you know, sometimes his tone goes off on certain things he's done. But
didn't he write Meet the Fockers?
No, that was Robert De Niro.
He definitely wrote Zoolander, which is an incredible movie. That's a very important, incredible movie.
Yeah, that's true. Incredible moments.
Yeah.
I love Zoolander. Wasn't I just saying I wanted to watch Zoolander like last night?
Yeah, you were very drunk, though.
Okay. I mean, makes sense. I want to watch Zoolander all the time.
Yeah.
Let's see.
What were you talking about?
No.
Yeah, right?
He did some other movie, like this movie called Wonder, which I had.
Oh, that was a long time ago, right?
2017.
Oh, never mind. Years, I don't know what it is.
A couple of years.
Oh, is that like Kevin Spacey's last movie before everybody got...
Before everyone found out he was a raper?
Yeah. No, that's...
He's not a raper, he's a pedophile.
Oh, okay. That's fine. That's fine, then.
No, this has... this actually does have Owen Wilson in it, so... But either way, most of the movies that he's written, I don't have that much interest in. The Pursuit of Happiness was a great movie, but it's like a huge bummer without the laughs.
Which is interesting because the way they the way like okay, it was Ebert. The way Ebert described this movie was like he's like one of the trade papers calls it. He's like. Does all of this make for a good movie? I think so. Absorbing, morbidly fascinating, which I can agree with that. That's 100% true. And then he goes on to say, one of the trade paper calls it, quote, one of the biggest downers to emerge from a major studio in recent memory, an overbearingly glum look at Chicago celebrity combing through the emotional wreckage of his life.
Was it a downer, though?
But this is what Ebert says. He goes on to say, but surely that is a description of the movie, not a criticism of it. Must movies not be depressing? Must major studios not release them if they are? Mm. And you know, it's true. Like, was it depressing or not? It's all perspective.
I found myself reveling in my own discomfort. While watching
the thing is like,
but not wallowing, you know,
Dave,
in it.
Dave does so much fumbling through his life, and it's a sympathetic character, if not for me sometimes an empathetic character, like when he's going to get the tartar sauce and like he just slowly like he's trying to repeat tartar sauce so he'll remember it this time, because clearly this is something that's happened 1 million times before in their right. marriage, and he just keeps on repeating it, and then like as he's walking down the street things come into his brain, he gets distracted by a butt
and wishing that he had two
all
dicks.
Sorts of stuff, and then by
wishing he had two dicks,
and then like and then by the time he gets to the store he does 100% forget the tartar sauce, and you get the idea from his wife that he's done this 1 million times before.
To me it almost seemed like in that era of like 2005 and before, when there was still that idea of middle class, the depression of that idea to me is what that movie is. It's like you have this family, you work hard to get this money, but it's all broken and you're all fragmented.
And none of you can talk about your feelings with each other in a healthy manner. Like you don't even know how to speak to somebody about a problem.
American achievement.
Right. That's what his dad said.
His dad's, when he gets like the bigger job at like the Today Show or whatever, what is it, Hello America? His dad says that's a very American accomplishment.
Because
he said American. That's like good money. That's very good money.
Right. Yeah, there was an underlying like thing of money going throughout the movie. Like he was telling to his daughter.
Well, the only way he can seem to calculate his worth is through like whether his salary goes up, I suppose.
There's other things too. Like he makes a comment to his daughter that she's. Grown up now and she needs to carry more money with her.
Yeah,
and there's several instances where he only has $1 in his wallet.
And his dad asks him for something that costs 25 cents and like he can't get the 25 cents.
Yeah,
so a couple of things real quick. That scene with where his dad asks him to buy him a paper and he has a quarter and he puts a quarter in and he opens the door to like the newspaper machine and then he loses his grip on the door and it slams shut and he doesn't have any more coins. So he only has the $1 because he gave a $20 bill to his daughter.
This is also an archaic problem for many people. But
But then he goes in to get change at, you know, an Arby's, and the little snot-nosed teenager behind the counter won't just give him change, which is something any of us who've ever worked in retail know that story.
We were told not to give change.
You're not allowed to.
Last week.
I can imagine them being real hard-asses about it.
That's why I love this movie so much, is because the teenager's like, he's not a dick about it. He's like, can I get some quarters? He's like, not really. He doesn't say no. He says, not really. Yeah. Like, my manager says no.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know the reason that you're not allowed to give change when you're, like, not a manager or an owner is because people are always shortchanging you. So they do the game where they, like, we're like, can I get a $20 back for this? Can I get a this back for that?
We also know that... Nicolas Cage is not going to do that.
Sure, it doesn't matter. It's policy, and the teenager's following policy.
When you work at an Arby's or at a Jewel Osco or at any of those places...
He doesn't have a code to get in the register for any other reason than ringing something
up.
Exactly. Well, he could have rung something up for a penny.
But he doesn't care. He works at fucking Arby's.
That's exactly, because it's too much. It's too much work for him... And too much for him to deal with, because he knows he's going to get in trouble for doing human decency, which is just giving the dude four quarters.
Which is 100% how, like, our entire system is set up.
Yeah.
And this is just, you know, a tiny little moment that, to me, is why I was saying I was reveling in the, like, discomfort of the movie. Because that is, I don't know, I feel like so much of it rings true for all different, you know, because... Even if you've never worked at an Arby's or at a Jewel Osco or a Walgreens or any of those sorts of places, you've probably been Nick Cage in that situation.
Well, you want to know what I was, Nick Cage?
And having to deal with being told, not really.
Yeah.
Well,
over four quarters.
Yeah, my moment is I've had a lot of things thrown at me throughout the course of my life.
Sure, yeah. Well, that's, I mean, that's a problem that's unique to you.
That's a theme... Yeah, throughout the film.
Yeah, I actually identify with that fully. Because I still get things thrown at me very often. Riding your bike, people just like to throw shit at your head out their car window.
This is true.
Yeah.
That might also be a little bit of a New Orleans problem, too.
I had it in Chicago, too, though.
I've had it in Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah. New Orleans, like, I grew up riding my bike everywhere. People would, A, yell things at you, and B, throw things at you.
Yeah.
I actually got... one of the moments that really resonated with me when I saw this movie was when he gets hit by the big gulp.
Yeah.
Because it reminded me of a time I worked at this like terrible coffee shop, and I was on my way to work, and I was like sitting on the back, towards the back of the bus, across from the two rear doors. And the way the rear doors would work on these buses was, like, they closed automatically. Like, when you push a button, you have to push it open, but they're, like, spring-loaded to close back. And there was a group of kids, like, sitting probably, like, four rows ahead of me. So, like, about three rows before my stop, these kids, like, all get up, and they go... it's three kids, and they go to walk to this back door, and they ring the bell. The guy stops... And two guys hold the door open, and the third one takes a big gulp and fucking pelts me with it. And it was red soda, too. And, like, and my uniform shirt was, like, this, like, stone gray shirt.
That's ruined.
So I was just like, So, like, and so...
And then it's going to be traumatic to watch again and again and again in this movie.
Went to work anyway and denied someone four quarters for a dollar.
Right, yeah.
I still had to go to work because I was too close to, like, turn around at that point. So I go in and my manager, you know, whatever. But I was just like, oh, God, it's a big gulp.
I think towards the end of the movie, he has this realization that, what people threw a Wendy's Frosty, a big gulp, McDonald's hot apple pie.
It was hot.
He had a soft taco thrown at him.
The montage falafel. Of getting hit.
Yeah, probably a Reuben. I don't know. I'm just...
Oh, the chicken.
Yeah. The chicken nuggets. But he has this realization. He's sitting in a food court with his son, and his son's up at the counter ordering something. He's thinking about all these things hitting him, and he just says... It's all fast food. That's all I am is fast food. That's my career. That's me. Everything. Yeah. Like, he's basically
an easy commodity. Issues.
And he says it's easier to throw it away than
than finish
it. It's so cheap, yeah, than to finish it. It's so cheap, it's easier to throw it away.
You'd rather throw it at someone.
And anger at someone who you don't like because they weren't, you know, their prediction of the weather didn't live up to your expectations. But he also, when he has that realization, I think it applies to the way he sees his family and the way he thinks mm-hmm. that they look at him.
Sure.
From his father, his ex-wife, his kids, mm-hmm. everyone looks
He's
at him
disposable.
As just...
disposable.
Yeah. And it's sad. It's
well, he has a few of these different sort of, like, rationalizations and realizations mm-hmm. throughout the movie. I think one of them is when he's sort of trying to rationalize why things get thrown at him, mm-hmm. and he talks about or thinks to himself about how his catchphrase is annoying.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, you know, like, why do so many people across so many different, you know, groups hate me to the point where they throw shit at me? And it, you know, and he says like, well, you know, my what is spritz,
who gets stuff
spritz nips the, or whatever
the spritz nipper
yeah. the spritz nipper spritz yeah
the cut scene to the
but he
the
says
husband
too,
and wife who he doesn't even know saying it
yeah
I hate
on their couch
yeah, yeah. That's sitting there yeah. like,
and
the like, away I hate from him.
She's like,
experience.
I like him, he's handsome, and he's like, yeah, that guy's an asshole.
Yeah.
He's got
I
an
hate
asshole
his hair.
He's
I
got
hate
an asshole
face.
Name.
There's, yeah, like there's so many incredible sequences of yeah, like that involve
face.
Like cursing and shit,
face.
And just like the things you say when you're truly done with something. So many characters in this movie say these things, and they say them so succinctly and so well. And just
yeah, well, he
so
calls
snappily.
The boyfriend who or the. Fiance or whatever, the future husband. He calls him a dildo.
Yeah,
dildo.
Yeah.
My favorite.
And then that's when his dad shows up and he says, David.
Dildo. One of my
what's
favorite.
With all what's with all the.
What's with
all the fucking, sucking and fucking and chucking?
Yeah, when he's
what's
trying
with
to.
The dildos and
he's
fucking.
Like, he's like trying to say, why is your life such a fucking mess? Which, because he's Nick Cage's dad and that's what he does, but he can't even get it out because, like, they're so emotionally. Unavailable to each
well,
and to him, like, who's somebody who prizes vocabulary and writing.
Yeah.
And he's a learned man, so he
he's
looks
reduced
at these
to this.
Profanities as an inability to communicate anger, an inability to communicate mm-hmm. frustration or mm-hmm. problems, or be able to deal with those problems.
And then when he's truly frustrated, he finds, like, this is the only words I have, even though I can't say them.
Well, so you know? I think that's like, those are huge points in the movie. So, like, one thing, his problem is that he's measuring himself against his father. So
right.
that's
who's
a huge thing.
Truly, instead like, of, just unique person. No, you know, like, out of the billions of people on the planet, not all of us are going to win the National Book Award and the
no,
Pulitzer. It's
no.
just not going to
yeah.
happen.
I mean, like, most of us probably will.
He's living
yeah.
in his
right.
not shadow
right.
most
right.
of his life.
Yeah.
And he's
yeah.
like, I just ended up the weatherman.
Right. Yeah.
And
there's,
so
there's another poignant scene, too, later where David's son says, yeah, Dad, I just want to be a cameraman for
the NFL.
You know, the
oh,
NFL.
Yeah, that
is
okay?
That okay? And he says,
yeah.
that's okay.
Yeah.
But and that's
like he seems to be getting there, but not for himself.
And that's
yeah.
and that's like and he gets that from like sort of like he has a realization during this movie where he realizes that he doesn't need to measure himself against his father. And the way that the point where I think he realizes that is where his father finally brings himself to say, you know, in this shit life, sometimes we must chuck some things.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
So he finally, yeah. like, just breaks it down to, like, David's language or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then, like, he finally teaches him, like, a lesson that he can pass on to his own kid. Because, like, that's also a really weird, I feel like that's a strange part of the movie, too. Because even though you have, like, Spritz interacting with his kids
mm-hmm.
throughout the whole movie and him interacting with his dad throughout the movie, it's not, or for me at least, like, it's not until like that moment when sort of that series of moments when he goes and beats up the
sure,
the dude
the
yeah so yeah his son is in rehab and he has a drug counselor who's actually grooming him
yeah
and, yeah, yeah and then can, it, and then it results yeah. in his son Nick. Is his son Nicholas? What's his son's name?
Nicholas Holt.
Mike.
Yeah.
His son Mike getting arrested, and
well, even in that,
but
he
like,
yeah, even in that, he doesn't like I guess like more the scene where, that you're talking about with the umbrella. That's the first time he seems like he's being a dad. Like in other times, right, the other times, even when he like beats up the dude or takes Shelly,
he seems to just be doing
like
what he's supposed to be doing, or what he thinks he should do.
Yeah.
He's searching. He's fumbling. He's trying to find how to do it.
Yeah.
Like, because that's what the archery is. Like, she offhandedly said something, and he's, like, latching onto anything he can get from his, like, not very communicative daughter.
Yeah.
You know?
He tried so hard. And
but also is confused and an alien at it.
Yeah, because I think one of the...
I think
at least
dad
in the,
is like that, too.
You know, one of the things sure. of the movie is at least the one of the obstacles David has to overcome is the difficulty between his generation and his father's generation of understanding what makes a man, mm-hmm. what makes the family man.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, he looks at his dad and he's like, my dad was talented. He had, but he was also, he makes a point of saying he was also a great family man. He was always there for the kids.
He says
he
that.
Always knows the right
words
to say and all the right things to do.
See,
yeah, true.
Well, but I don't.
We're talking about his idea of an ideal man and an ideal family man and him not being able to live up to it.
So the scene where Dave's father passes on that sometimes you have to just chuck it or whatever, that's a resolution to the point, again, extremely awkward and uncomfortable moment at the living funeral that they do where Dave is about to deliver his speech eulogize
some tense moments.
So his father is dying of lymphoma. It's advanced. They can't do anything about it. Or leukemia. It's advanced. It's a cancer that's metastasized. It's too advanced. They can't do anything. So his mom comes, you know, they all decide to have a living memorial for him before he dies, where, you know, everybody in, like, you know, the Western world is invited because he's a famous author, and everybody gives speeches. And so it's time for David to make his speech about his father. And he only gets to read the first sentence before the power goes out and all goes. And he says, when I think of my father, I think of Bob Seger's Like a Rock.
And then the power goes out and everyone, you know, after the power comes back on, like, you know,
they're not even
15
doing the
minutes
readings.
Later.
40 minutes. They said 40
minutes. Oh, 40
minutes
later.
So, like, everybody's forgotten that we were even doing readings.
Yeah,
and so he's like, that's all I got to do at my, say at my dad's living funeral was
Bob Seger's Like a Rock. Which is the only thing that I think of when I think of that song is the, like, Ford or possibly Chevy pickup truck commercial.
I thought it was a beer commercial, but
because
it
probably also is.
At that time, is 100% when they were running that commercial.
I believe it. but the resolution to that super awkward moment is his father, who is like very much dying at this point, although he doesn't ever really look it in the movie, plays the song. Like in the car,
because he says,
and then says he doesn't understand.
Yeah, it.
He says,
well,
what did you mean?
Yeah, but
I don't quite get it.
Yeah, but
I
the
don't
fact
quite follow
the fact that his father went ahead and listened to a song that you know he would never listen to in a million
to
years
to try to puzzle it out.
Yeah, without having knowing anything, because all he said was the title of the song. Yeah. So he obviously sought this out to try and make some sort
understood
of connection with his son.
He spent 24 hours of the last days of his life trying to figure it out.
Instead of just asking his son. Yeah.
But he does, though.
He does.
He does.
He does. He but he, you
doesn't
know,
do it for a while.
And you also have to think, like, at this time, you couldn't
listening.
Just Google the song. He had to, like...
Yes, you could. It was 2005.
No, you could go buy a CD. And
no,
you
because,
there was
because
no Spotify.
Nicholas,
there
incidentally,
was no,
he tries to do marriage counseling with his wife that's very clearly, like, dating another man now.
Sure.
And they have to do like a trust exercise, and like the woman's like, okay, I need you to I need you to describe one thing that you've never told your spouse about. And he starts saying it out loud. And it's, he's like, I had a problem with porn on the computer. Like, meaning he was on the internet doing a bunch of porn, which you could totally do back then.
Sure, yeah, but you, could but you couldn't.
You're incredibly from fast the internet. Comfort you couldn't early 2000s. Yes. You totally could.
That dude's dad would not have been able to look up the song on the internet.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. He's a famous author. He has to do a lot of communication.
I don't know. He would have bought a CD.
I don't know. He would have bought a CD.
It's fine. No. So what we've
come, I know I'm correct.
The conclusion that we've come to is that Amanda decided at the beginning of the movie that her Michael Caine's character is a piece of shit, and she's not going to. She's like, because even when he says he's a fine father, and she's like, fine father, like out loud. So you've already made your decision that he's not a fine father.
Yeah,
I have.
Again, this is all through Dave Spritz's lens, you know. So I saw several situations where his father was obviously trying to do the right thing, and they have obviously a strained relationship for whatever reason, probably because the father's approach to communicating is a little bit abrupt.
He's very direct.
Yeah,
I'm sure the conversation.
Direct but inscrutable. Mm. I mean, at least he is for David. David finds his father completely inscrutable all the time. I'm sorry.
Good job. My God.
It's my doctor.
Interesting. Uh-oh.
Is it the lymphoma?
No, it's like Toro calling me at 7 p.m. every night until my appointment on Tuesday.
Every night, huh?
Yeah, they called me last night at 7 p.m. too, and I didn't answer it then because I thought it was stupid.
It's cool. Probably a robot.
That's I just find it strange that you still had your ringer on if you knew you were getting a phone call at 7 p.m.
I didn't. I didn't know that they'd keep on doing it.
Kitty.
Oh, no.
Kitty.
Where's Mark?
Reel it back in.
Where is that cat, though?
So one funny thing about this movie, we can get back to serious stuff.
Okay. Just the one.
The serious.
No. This is like another fun fact. So every single piece of food in the movie that was thrown at Dave Spritz, Gore Verbinski threw it at Nicolas Cage.
Oh, really? Yeah. Nice. That's incredible. That's really good.
And
this does seem like it was a personal project for Gore. Yeah.
And then as far as like the Nicolas Cage, the statement or the thing that you're saying earlier about this seemed like a deeply personal movie for Nicolas Cage. So he does talk about like in some post-production stuff about like his inspiration for this character. Like he basically thought about his own life and how he had a failed marriage and estranged kids and a house that he didn't live in. And that he basically felt like a failure. So like,
okay,
sure. Yeah.
That dildo.
Yeah.
Well, you know, personally, I came from my parents were divorced when I was about the age his daughter was in this movie.
Mm,
and
mm-hmm.
I think this is maybe one of the first movies I saw where I feel like that kind of, I don't know, the aftermath of a divorce, I feel like it was portrayed in a really relatable way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I felt I understood Nicolas Cage. Right. I felt like I understood each of his children, the ex-wife. Everyone who's surrounded and affected by this divorce, I felt like they did a really good job.
Yeah, it was
showing
all
that
accurate.
Even if they're the periphery, but
they are still
even
like
with
they
Nick, with David being in the center of the focus here, it's
right.
His perspective. But I think I don't know. There's got to be something about that.
It's interesting. And I suppose that's like between the writer and the director that they were able to still like, you know, with not very many lines, still sketch out these characters as, you know, recognizable, you know, like characters that we could also sympathize or empathize with.
Yeah.
Even though they're
with
just
parents that are
even though
together,
we're 100%.
That was my parents' relationship for like Why didn't you get divorced?
Like the fighting scene when the parents start fighting over the tartar sauce.
And when he's
in their own bathroom, get up from the dinner table, the teenage, stand up, walk up the steps to their rooms.
And the teenage boy goes in his middle class room and turns on his bubble big ol' TV, tube TV, and then
the volume
thing goes up. And I was like, oh, that's a really familiar scenario.
Exactly. I was like,
I've done that a lot.
One of the things that I thought was...
And my parents aren't even divorced.
Exactly.
That illustrated kind of how their marriage fell apart, though, was in the tartar sauce scene when he realizes he forgot the tartar sauce and she's, seemingly a little bit more angry than one would be about tartar sauce. He very easily and quickly lies
instead of just saying I forgot
about the tartar sauce being out of tartar sauce.
Yeah.
And then she has this insane overreaction of like I'm
but
calling them.
But it might be to the lying, That's probably why she was lying, not the forgetting. Amanda was saying, this is like a building scenario. It had nothing to do with the tartar sauce. It's probably the fact that he went quickly to a lie that the reason she wanted to call was because she knew.
But there was no fumbling. Like there's plenty of times in the movie where he's fumbling over his words.
When you're in a relationship with somebody, you get to see the rhythm.
Yeah, exactly.
She probably got to know the rhythm after a million other.
Oh yeah. What I'm focusing on is how, despite us seeing him fumble, like he calls someone like a fuck and a dildo, obviously he will stumble over, like when he's in a tense situation and feeling emotional and things like that. He's not necessarily the most eloquent of people, but he very easily and quickly and casually lies. Oh yeah, no, they were out. I told them, and they apologized.
Yeah, he had some extra embellishment that's not necessary.
Like thing that he obviously just came up with because he forgot the tartar sauce.
Yeah,
but quickly is just he's able to think on his feet. Mm-hmm. Enough to lie about something like tartar sauce instead of being like, God damn it, I forgot.
Also, I just want to point out that the home they were living in is in Evanston, Illinois. It's actually a suburb of Chicago,
yes,
a very close suburb. The restaurant he went to get this takeout food was in Wicker Park,
that's
15 miles away.
Yeah.
I actually thought that when he was walking up the city streets. I'm like, wait, they live in the suburbs. Like how did he, why is he going here for food?
I mean, it makes sense to work downtown and commute.
Sure.
Right. Home. If you're bringing it home from
But work, he left the house
but
to go to Wicker
two
Park.
Hours, to drive like 3 hours through traffic to Wicker Park.
Yeah.
It's like, no.
To get
the best tartar sauce in Chicago.
Maybe. Yeah. What even was the food that needed
something
tartar
that required
sauce?
Tartar sauce?
What, fish sticks?
Chips. Probably fish and chips. Yeah.
I mean, nice.
In Wicker Park.
I mean, his dad's British. He grew up on fish and chips. Yeah.
Well, actually, I think he was trying to be American in that movie.
No.
I think so.
No.
Really?
I think he was genuinely trying to cover up his English accent.
Well, what he sounded like was like a man who had moved to America a long time ago I feel like the fact that he calls it a very American accomplishment 100% outlines that he was British. Like
he says
a true American accomplishment. Yeah.
Does he say true?
He says it's a true American accomplishment.
A weird old white man might just say that, though.
I don't know.
I think he's supposed to be an immigrant.
Sarcastic.
Yeah, I think he is.
Yeah.
Although I did notice that he had much less of a British accent than he normally does. But he may have been hamming it up in other movies.
But he does.
But also, British people that live here for a long time will, anywhere that you live, you'll, really reduce your own accent and adopt the native one.
This
He had a much more British accent in Batman Begins, that trilogy.
Well, they probably really want to
but
be like him.
He was like, well, so yeah. Those are like.
Because they got a real butler imported from Butlerland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's where butlers come from.
Yes.
I thought you said he was a bodyguard.
No, in the Batman,
sorry,
he's
we're not
much
talking about
more.
Batman. I'm so sorry.
He's much more of a bodyguard. I guess
it
depends
Alfred.
Which Batman lore you're talking about. Because basically, in every Batman lore, Alfred is like a former MI6 well, like operative of some sort.
But point being, no, because so first of all, Michael Caine's like a great actor, and he's also aware. If you watch any movies that, and this is just maybe I'm being a dick, but if you watch him in different movies, he has different accents in different movies because his natural, he's from, I can't remember where he's from, but he's from like a poorer part. So his natural accent. So his accent.
Is he like Liverpool or like somewhere in the South?
I don't know. I'm not going to guess because our British fans will get really mad at me.
Yes.
Yes, our British.
Manchester.
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in. When, follow us on, follow or contribute to our Patreon at patreon.com, which whatever our thing is.
So when he has like the Alfred accent, I think he has like a lower station in life sort of like
it's
regional
very,
accent.
Yeah.
And then
more
the,
Cockney. Yeah. I think that's the term.
Well,
I thought it was Liverpudlian.
Cockney is like a
oh, is that
slang.
A specific like
his distinctive South like, London accent.
South London. South, that's South also side.
That's where the that's chimney horror. Sweeps come yeah, yeah. from, right?
Yeah, I think so. But I think he uses like a different accent, perhaps for this to say that he's from a more affluent, and possibly. I just think he is purposefully done. I don't think anyone was like necessarily because. So Gore Verbinski said that he cast Nicolas Cage in this movie specifically because of his acting range or whatever, and that he wanted to see like Nicolas Cage. Play a serious character, but also use his other chops, and which is the same reason that Nicolas Cage states that he took it because
well,
he wanted to do.
In his delivery of these really dark, comedic, I don't even know if they're jokes. They're not technically jokes,
right?
But what do you call that? He plays a straight man really well. And
acerbic critiques.
Yeah. What did you say?
Acerbic wit, or I don't know.
You had a it's witty.
What did he say?
You had you'd said something earlier in during the movie about his ability to wear suffering and
Nicolas Cage.
Yeah,
like those. I mean, like somehow, like his face, like he's able to just make these looks that convey the entire like.
Oh wait, can I do a real side note?
Yeah.
Sorry, everyone. Okay, so when I worked at that video store that I brought up probably every podcast, I did a Nicolas Cage.
Like a staff picks, like wall.
Staff picks, but it was all Nick Cage.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was still VHS at this time.
This is before he was, I mean.
It was endlessly
Face
entertaining.
Off was
there wasn't
in
a
it.
Dud.
Right, Face Off was in that VHS thing.
He was on
but
the rise.
I picked it purely because of all the intense faces that he was making on every cover of the VHS.
He's not incredibly hammy in this movie.
No,
but,
he's not. I
but
he
it's still
job.
Just, I like the, what's the word? Like, when we have these just long shots of his face, he's not, like, grimacing or anything, but, like, it's enough. Like, I guess just a little bit of a furrow in his brow, and then...
He has a little bit of the Tom York eyes a lot in this movie. Like half closed, heavy lids, heavy upper lids.
Yeah, I mean he seems exhausted.
And
confused,
and he conveys that real well.
Tom York face,
and like he's not enjoying his life or like the things he's accomplished, even and the fact that he can live in that or his family can live in that house in Evanston. That's like a fucking mansion. We all
right,
like,
but he's like confused. He's like, I must be doing something terribly wrong because I don't like what's happening right now.
And
which is his marriage dissolving.
And he thinks that by getting this dream job with the Hello America, it's going to give him a new chance to move the whole family, including his estranged
wife.
Right, because he mentioned something like, can we try this
which
again?
Which is also, again, an emotionally stunted idea, which
is
where
a lot of
his like issues arise.
But I think that goes back to that idea of what middle class was still at that time in 2005, where you have this idea of you have to have this nuclear family, like this... You know,
nuclear. It's pronounced nuclear.
In 2005,
what did
I
say?
I think it was nuclear.
No,
it was
doing
nuclear in 2005.
Bush was president. I think it was nuclear.
Okay,
I was,
well,
I was
what
doing
the
Homer
ever.
Simpson thing.
I'm just saying, like at that time,
from the same era. It was
yeah,
topical.
It was still very much like people felt a sense of failure with divorce. They felt a sense of failure with like, I don't know, all these things that like I feel like at this point it's kind of like, I mean, who even cares about marriage? I mean. four of us are married here, but like, I don't know, like
to each other.
Wow, we made the fifth one feel like a fifth wheel. Yeah. Wow.
That was a good show.
Yeah, I just mean like.
No, that's okay.
That was a good show.
You're both.
I don't want to be married.
I mean, I remember
Boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no, that was a limit date. Never mind.
Yeah. Like, too much, but, like, even going into marriage, being like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, like, I want to do this, but, like, I mean, it could implode at any moment, and, like, whatever's going to happen is going to happen, but, like, you know, I don't
One thing I thought was interesting about that was when he is suggesting, like, when this whole Hello America job comes up, he brings up that, like, he'll be making one, and we can go into the whole money thing, probably off mic, but $1.2 million a year, and he brings that up to his estranged slash possibly ex-wife at this time,
mm-hmm.
As, like, this could really change, like, this could be a huge positive for, like, our family and whatever, almost as though he's come to a point where he has decided his only real worth and the only thing he can contribute is the amount of money he brings in, which is again reiterated by his father when he says that's a true American accomplishment.
Yeah.
And says that's more money than I've ever made mm-hmm. in a year.
Yeah.
You know, so
which his dad had given him some like kind of
and that was for
nabs
his,
about not being an actual meteorologist.
Yeah. Sure. He said, well, you didn't go to college for what does he say? Like you didn't.
You don't have a degree in meteorology.
So it's kind of the opposite of that speech he had been getting up until that point.
Yeah, but and it's sort of, you know, that's a compliment in a way from his dad. But just that air of depression over the entire movie where it's like he's trying with his daughter to be a father. He's sort of, you know, he's trying with his son in a way because he's promised him this, like, very expensive $600 camera if he's able to, you know. So he's doing these things that a father would do, but at the same time, he's seeing his own worth being reduced to a paycheck.
Well, it's also it's like,
right, because the shopping was
well,
bribing.
Well, is it bribing? I mean, this might also be like, he clearly, like, they clearly all have some sort of, like, communication and interaction, like, issues, disorders, whatever. But, like, this is almost, like, the love language. Like, his love language is gift-giving mm-hmm. or something. And unfortunately, that's not anybody else in his family's love language. That's not what they want or need.
I don't know.
And he
I feel...
can't seem to understand or figure out what
I don't know
it is
if it's
that
a...
they want or need.
I don't know if it's a love language. I feel like he's just kind of throwing money at a problem.
Yeah.
And I feel like he's doing the only thing he can do, right?
Yeah, which is throw money at a problem.
He's being intentional and well-meaning. Like, he's going to go shopping with his daughter to fix this
camel toe problem. Yeah.
Like, he cares about her. He doesn't want her to, like...
He doesn't want her to be mocked, and he also doesn't want her to have a camel toe.
Right, but I think it is a love language in a way. It's his solution to the problems that he sees.
It's the only thing he's capable of doing.
Right.
I feel like the shopping trip, honestly, was more of a transition from... throwing money at a problem to becoming more of an actual father because instead of
he didn't give her $20 and be like here buy
yeah
a
but he
soda.
Probably spent like $200-$300
but he didn't like in the beginning of the movie he gives her $20 to stop at the store and is like okay bye like not that he doesn't give a shit but that's like his
more passive
he's just like okay this is what you want I guess this is what we're getting
well that
I'll
seemed
buy
to
you
me
a
was
lessons
really
pack.
Sweet
or but he's doing it like he's like well if this is what you want this is what I'll do for you
yeah but
please
when,
love me now
but then, when he does the clothes thing he's like well
he's
not
participating
a,
with her
yeah the yeah. one thing mm-hmm. that I can
that's
contribute is money because I make $240,000 a year but also like we can solve this problem and like and he kind of, like, is doubting himself about, even about, like, I feel like he's doubting himself about, like, the method that he's taking. Because he's like, am I just throwing the money at the problem? Because remember, he, like, stops in the middle of it, has a conversation, and then realizes, okay, we can fix this.
Right.
And then he sort of, like, encourages her to, like, you know, look, she's more grown up. Because the other thing that you have to... I think, like, there's so many, like, weird little things that are written to this movie that you have to take into account. The other problem with his relationship with his kids is that his daughter's 12 years old, mm-hmm. which she's a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
or she's becoming a monster.
She's buying a bunch of cigarettes to go smoke outside after school.
And her son is a teenager. So he has two teenage children that basically really don't want, like, they don't want to have anything to do with him.
Sure.
Like, when he shows
they
up.
They don't. She does seem kind of happy when she gets some attention. Well, the thing is like, none of the attention is ever right until it is, and then she's thrilled.
Yeah,
but most of it's not.
But that seems accurate.
Yeah.
For that.
I've never been a teenage girl, but I think, like, as far as, like, I feel like as far as, like, that, this, like, the extremely, I thought one thing that was really accurate was when he shows up for the picnic, and, like, like, I'm going to take the kids to the picnic, and she's just, like,
what the fuck?
Completely flabbergasted because he just shows up. He's like, okay, you could have called or something like that.
Right.
But, like, I perhaps didn't want to invite my parents to anything at that age. Like,
well but also, you don't company
just
picnic.
Show the fuck up and say, okay, it's time to go.
Right.
Well, no, and then... And
I mean,
then,
she's reasonably like, you didn't mention this to me, period, dot. Same to the kids. The kids didn't know, you know, it's just like, now my dad showed up and wants to take me somewhere.
But let's back up. Before any, even the shopping trip, he... there's a flashback where he takes her to an archery range, and because she had expressed interest in archery.
Well, and he asked her what she wanted to do, and she said something along the lines of, like, I don't know, archery.
Yeah, and so, you know, he spends, it shows him, them swiping his card, you know, the checks for how much money he spent on all the lessons. He tells you how much he spent on the lessons, the bows and the arrow and the bracelet that she wears for it. And in the end, well, you know, after repeated attempts to get her interested, okay, why isn't she interested in this? She's like, well, really, it's not the range shooting that interests me. I'm more interested in
killing something.
Actually hunting. But
killing an animal.
But I do find...
Is it even hunting? I think she just wants to kill something.
So then for him to do this shopping trip and... You know, he's making it. He keeps making an effort to find. Okay, that doesn't work. So what?
He's listening.
And he keeps trying. He keeps trying.
But it's also all off the cuff. Like, he's so scattered that he hears one thing and fixates on it instead of stopping and having a deeper discussion.
Isn't that what we all do in real life?
Well,
I don't know. Honestly, that one moment when he was taking that walk to the tartar search. when he was having that moment of being in his head, that was so chaotic to me. I don't have thoughts in that rapid kind of motion. That to me felt like, okay, like that was a real insight into how he's thinking and like, I don't know that.
I don't know. It felt really familiar to me. I've done that a lot.
That's like,
I have one goal. And by the time I'm like 50 feet away, I don't remember what it is, and I've thought about 100 other things.
Well, and I think the glimpse into his thought process there...
I don't think about...
This was shown in 15, 20 seconds.
That's not a common one, but...
This would have been like a 20-minute drive, you know?
Right.
The things he's thinking about.
Right.
Well, and I'm not saying I don't think about different things, but like that quick succession, or like even the fact you had to keep repeating tartar... Like, I can't say that word...
I've had to try to do the repeating to try to remember something, and like, I still forget.
I don't know. To me, I'm just going along my day, and that stood out to me as, like, this is this character. He's very chaotic, like, within his own thoughts. So even, I don't know.
He's very chaotic, and that's a lot of, like, what I think, like, leads to the struggles in his relationships. But also, like, he's unable to express what he is, so his family, you know... never really understand what's actually happening, and he just seems like an inconsiderate person all the time.
Right.
But doesn't the archery have kind of a... have a metaphor for him trying to teach his daughter focus and goals?
Yeah. But he's teaching
himself. Actually, I feel like and that gave him some great. Focus, though. Archery gave him focus.
As he struggles with his anger issues and his his communication issues... really towards the end of the movie, when you start to see the resolution, he begins to be able to focus and hit the target because he is focusing on his own targets.
Right.
He's not trying to impress anybody. He's accepted the fact that you know, his family's not the picture perfect thing that he would have wanted, or his dad would have wanted, or his kids would have wanted.
Yeah.
But he's doing what he helps can. Him.
Right.
And
I saw that.
I think maybe there's, maybe I'm reading into it, but
I mean, he I wants to help his kids. Accurately.
He wants his kids to maybe find whatever a their focus. Target is.
Right.
Well, yeah. when and he decides to go learn the archery himself to teach it to her, him doing the archery classes is almost like, frankly, like a sort of like cognitive behavioral therapy for himself.
Sure.
Like mm-hmm. he's learning from the archery right. to focus, to breathe, to do a mental checklist to get some focus.
Right.
Not at first, but that does.
But when he goes back the second time,
yeah.
when he goes back the second time and he takes the lessons for himself.
Yep.
Like, it's he is somehow getting like sort of like this indirect therapy for his own scatteredness, you know, by engaging in a task that require, you know, a task with steps that somebody teaches him to, like that an archery professional teaches him how
he's
to do.
Finding a zen. He's finding a...
He's learning to engage in life on life's terms.
He's learning how to sort his thoughts.
Thanks. Yeah.
Or
and maybe remember the tartar sauce or to breathe.
Right. Just breathe, Nicolas Cage.
Or just like take care of himself instead of like try to like take like
flounder at taking care of others.
Well, I mean,
unsuccessfully.
He's not really floundering. It's just like
he feels like he's
well, that's fair. But like, he's not necessarily floundering.
Yeah.
Like his daughter, like the introduction to like his daughter is like a flaky 12-year-old.
Yeah. Like, she's a depressed kid.
She's in a dance class when he picks her up, and then he starts talking about the aero classes, but really she just wants to smoke cigarettes and like hang out.
She's 12.
Or
I can relate.
Yeah, exactly.
And talk about some classmate
that she wants to burn.
The funny thing is, in watching her in her real state, she really reminds me of Nicolas Cage. Like, it's clearly his daughter.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
Well, maybe that's why they have that bonding, those bonding scenes with the archery. And
like, she doesn't know what she wants ever, and he doesn't know what he wants, and she can't focus on anything for, like, any period of time. And, like, I mean, to a degree, that's, you know, when they both can focus on something together, like, wearing great clothes.
Is it too late for a sequel?
I would really love a sequel.
But, like, where particularly...
sequel at any point.
Yeah, without the snow and the ice, maybe it would be summery.
Honestly, it'll be Shelley's relationship with her father and who Shelley becomes.
Oh yeah, they could do that's
like
perfect.
Like Meet the Fockers.
I don't know what that
God.
Is.
Exactly, not like that.
So they wanted to the studio wanted them to film this movie, even though it was set in Chicago. They wanted to film it in Canada.
Because it's cheaper, right?
Yeah. But Nicolas Cage and Gore Verbinski were like, we're doing it in Chicago.
Yeah, okay.
Chicago is a character in this movie, which is why we invited the Chicago experts.
Just another little sidebar, like, because there's three Chicagoans here, and Aaron, you're a Chicagoan.
Three?
Yeah.
He's not a Schmidt.
Well, and you
he's
said,
like
and Aero, you're a Chicagoan.
Aaron. Wow. Because Aaron grew up in Peoria, but lived in Chicago.
Who's the third?
I spent my 20s in Chicago.
I know, but...
One.
Oh, the way Rose. That she two. Said the sentence is confusing, Chuck.
Okay.
But what she meant was this. This is what she meant.
Okay, never mind.
One, two, three.
Start the sentence over.
I can't.
No,
I don't even know what
it's
sentence initially.
I think you said there's
Kira.
Three Chicagoans here.
Start the sentence over.
No, don't.
Okay, well, no. Okay.
It was fine. What she said was fine. You just misheard it.
No, it wasn't. It was not fine.
I
you just heard it.
I don't know even why we're arguing.
Oh boy.
Well, this is what Rogue is like to do sometimes.
So we should probably wrap it up.
No, it was fun to
see like little scenes where you definitely know you've been. And I know you could say that of any city where things have been filmed. Like we watch things in New Orleans that have been filmed.
Oh, yeah.
Filmed.
Yeah.
Well,
no,
Kira,
it's
you
nothing
said,
like watching
you
in
said
New
I've
Orleans
been there
being like,
nine
I know where
times.
That is and this movie
yeah,
sucks.
Yeah, I've been there.
Been there, done that.
Are there any good films filmed in New Orleans?
Operation Power or like what?
Oh, Port of Call.
Power?
That's another Nicolas Cage movie.
We're not talking about New Orleans.
Yeah.
How did you feel about the representation of Chicago?
Actually, very accurate. It gave me feelings of, I'm really glad we left. Mostly because it was like winter scenes and like seeing a lot of ice and then like seeing the traffic and I don't know. There was parts that I did write one note. I missed the lake. I do miss the lake, but not in the winter.
There is something really beautiful about watching the thick, several inch thick ice breaking up. And it breaks into plates where those plates were moving up against each other.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. Under the waves. It is really, and it makes a sound. The sound
it does.
Is
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It looks like scales or something. It's really weird.
Yeah. Yeah. You can hear the groaning and cracking of the lake, at certain points in the year.
Yeah.
And it's, there's the ice cracking in like the very early spring can sound like a gunshot, which blends in with all the other gunshots.
The orchestra, the symphony of sounds in the city.
Yeah. But no, it was an accurate, and also like just kind of life being kind of fast paced and very much Chicago is kind of like a keeping up with the Joneses kind of city.
The kind of attitude and also like the people throwing shit at the weatherman. Also like
Tom Skilling,
my partner. Tom Skilling. I don't know what that was about, but
she was just excited.
He was a weatherman in Chicago.
He consulted with the weather sets.
Yeah.
Wait, I think it, yeah he was. Yeah, he did.
Yeah, Channel 9 WGN. Tom Skilling.
Yeah.
My partner over at my current
job. I didn't write
job
that down, but I did write.
Will sometimes ask me because he's from the South. He's from Houma and now lives in New Orleans and all that. And he'll sometimes see things like pedestrians like crossing at a red light. And we'll ask, like, what would they do in Chicago or whatever? And I was like, oh, the cars would just start driving.
Yeah.
And they would be yelling, like, get out of the road, you fucking asshole, or, like, whatever, you know? Like, they would just drive. They wouldn't sit there and wait for this person to cross.
Yeah,
they
would
start driving
It's a very New Orleans thing to just wait for whoever's having their problem or their conversation
Chicago
to just have
wait.
It.
Chicago doesn't know their neighbors. Chicago doesn't care who you are. Get out of my way.
Yeah, and they will yell at you.
Yeah.
With no fear of being shot at or whatever.
Like sometimes when the traffic backs up here when kids are being picked up after school, and like I won't lie, if somebody gets caught in that traffic, number one, they're an idiot because it's very clear that this is a school zone. There's buses everywhere. There's a giant school. But when somebody starts honking like a maniac because they got caught in it, everybody, like, that's when everybody wants to cut that. Like, everybody wants to cut that person.
Sure.
You're in this,
you know, like, people, like, get out of their houses and start staring and, like, filming the person who's honking their horn in traffic.
Yeah, it's almost the opposite
today,
in a lot of ways.
Today there was a 5K here in New Orleans that I was working at.
I think it wasn't a 10K.
It was a 5K, 10K. Oh.
Yeah.
Depending on how ambitious you were.
Yeah.
And there was a gentleman on a bicycle that was approaching the race line and was trying to cut through.
Yeah, and that shit happens too.
There was two cops sitting in their cars, not doing anything.
Right.
And my partner had brought something up about that and how would that happen in Chicago? And I was like, oh, those cops would have been ripping that dude off the bike.
Right,
and beating him physically while telling him to stop resisting and calling him a fucking dumbass for trying to cross something.
I don't know. I've met some nice Chicago cops. One time I was peeing in an alley and the cops pulled up behind me. And they was like, hey, what are you doing? And I was like, nothing. And they said, where do you live? And I like zipped up and I was like, two blocks that way, and they're like, all right, you should go home. They let me off the hook.
Yeah, but if you tried to cross...
I said a prayer for the Chicago police that night.
If you tried to cross the Chicago Marathon on a bicycle, do you think they wouldn't rip you off your bike and proceed to start beating you?
Well, yeah, because you guys kept on saying that, like, every time he was carrying around the bow, they were like, he would be arrested 10 minutes ago. Yes. And I was like, oh, you can't carry arrows around?
No!
Yeah, and I don't know why I thought that. I don't know. If somebody was carrying arrows around here, too, I would be like, something's up.
I don't think you would even think twice.
Oh, no. If I saw somebody with a weapon,
I don't know. I cross that bridge over to Araby every day, and I see some weird shit every day.
Well, that's Araby.
But we also have cell phones, and in this movie, they were a little bit less prevalent.
Yeah.
I feel like in Chicago, probably everyone had a cell phone back then in 2005.
Yeah.
But still, if you saw someone walking with a weapon, you might think, okay, you know, like if he passed 100 people, I would say maybe 20 of those people would call the cops.
Yeah, at the very
you
least.
Know,
it's
like,
a very big
Chicago.
Brother. Right. Yeah. People.
Well, you just don't. You
well,
see
it
something.
It seems like it's a very Midwest.
Right?
Exactly. It's a very Midwest. Like, the way we keep order is by keeping order.
Right.
Well,
you know.
Yeah. This is technically probably still pre 9/11, too.
No,
oh, no,
it's not 9/11.
No, post.
Oh, my. 2000.
Yeah, it's
oh
been. It's a couple years later.
Wow.
I know. There's still one quote from this movie that I don't think has been uttered in this podcast.
Right.
That was repeated, and it was kind of a thread through the movie.
At least twice, and it's maybe the linchpin of the movie.
Can you read my handwriting?
Yeah. Well, like, one of the common... A common reoccurrence is that people from the street will walk up
birds.
To him.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay. We have some night birds that are out there for some
reason.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
They do. They chirp.
Oh,
yeah.
I thought it was one of those clocks.
No, there's really birds out there that make noise about right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
One of the reoccurring scenarios in the movie is that strangers will walk up to David Spritz and say, "Oh man, hey,
yeah,
what's the weather gonna do this week?"
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like, "Fuck, I don't know. Leave me alone. I'm like waiting at the DMV.
Yeah.
Like I'm just trying to get my tags renewed." Or he's like, you know, maybe just got a parking ticket. He's like, this is not a good time. Please don't talk to me.
Yeah.
And finally, in the finale of the movie, he says to somebody, "Fuck, man, I don't know. It's the wind. It just blows all over the place."
Yeah,
wind,
and
that's him. That's his takeaway from the movie.
Yeah.
Is just
yeah.
Like, I don't know what you can't predict things. You can't predict life. You just go with the flow.
Yeah.
You can't control
prepare,
it. You can't
prepare yourself.
It. Yeah, yeah.
What's interesting is he learns that from the meteorologist. You know, like some people criticize him for not actually having a meteorology degree, like implying that he's some sort of, you know,
he reads
a sham or something.
Yeah.
But so he goes to the meteorologist at his workplace in Chicago and is like, "I need to learn this. Can you explain this to me more? I need to know why. I need to know why." And like the actual meteorologist says, "I don't know. It's fucking wind. It blows all over the place."
Yeah.
And like something clicks for him then, which is like, "Oh, even if I did have this degree, I wouldn't know any more than I already do." You know, like this isn't actually an important thing that like my, you know, this isn't an important thing, even if some people who don't know any better think that it might be. Mm-hmm.
It's
like
a crack
his dad.
In his insecurity, that hard
right,
shell
that,
of insecurity
that suddenly,
he has.
Suddenly,
it's a crack in it, and then it starts to shatter.
Right,
as
and then,
he makes these realizations, like, "I'm doing fine." Like,
or you know, like just like all this shit that's happening in my life, I maybe don't have a lot of control over some of it.
And,
like especially like you know whatever's happening with those kids.
And you don't have control over the weather. I mean,
yeah.
And that's why I don't find this movie to be depressing. It's
right,
very dark.
Right.
It's dark comedy.
Yeah,
you're laughing at things that normally you wouldn't find funny, but.
Sometimes just out of pure discomfort.
Overall, I think it just, I think it's a very thought-provoking
film. Or identifying
film.
With their frustration. Like, when everybody breaks down into cursing, it's funny. Because it is well-timed and well-filmed and well-paced.
Absolutely.
Whenever anybody breaks down into cursing in this movie. I mean, some people might say there's a lot of cursing in this movie, but it's not. This is oddly effective cursing. It's not all throwaway, even though it's common.
Even the,
and every time
the counselor,
you're like,
the drug counselor, who,
right,
they,
fuck.
Who Mike says... Yeah, I don't know, like, to a friend. He's like, "I don't know, he swears a lot."
Yeah.
That's
Chicago.
To try to relate.
Exactly.
To try to relate, he
and,
goes...
And that swearing is very poorly placed
in
the
weird.
Context
yeah.
of the
creepy.
Conversation, but
which
for,
is why
for the
he's
movie...
immediately, like, a suspect character.
Sure.
You're like, ooh, I don't
like all the cursing is, like, funny, but also cathartic, because, like, in every one of those situations, you're like, this is being used in a specific way, and this is, like... The only way you could possibly explain your feelings
and
right
I mean,
now.
It's an admission to, I don't know what to say.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. It's wind. It, I don't know. It blows all over the place. Like, I don't know.
That's a much cleaner, less profane way of saying fuck.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Shit. You dildo. Like,
you dildo, yeah. Shit.
You dildo.
He's just like, I don't know.
My favorite is
chucking and fucking.
No.
Chucking and fucking.
Sucking and chucking. Chucking and sucking and chucking and sucking and chucking.
Was it
and
pork fuck porker?
Pork fuck. So that's my favorite.
That's a good one.
I'm his still, fucking asshole
so
face.
So one of my aspirations is to, I want to do like a little a music project, whether it's a band or some project that I do called Pork Fucks. and the album will be called Police Sex. And I don't know what the theme of it's going
to
be, but like
I'd like to sign up.
At least one lyric has to be.
I would love to be a member of
Pork Fucks. Yes. Pork Fucks. Police Sex.
But I think everybody that sees that movie, like, I mean, of course, like Aaron's right. You fixate on that quote because it is the gist of the movie. Like, you know, like
Windman. It's all over the place.
It's profound in its own sort of, you know, very kind of like dumb and.
It's dumb, reductive, like, toss-off, but it is. Yeah. Like, that's the central theme of the movie. It's like, I don't know, it's wind, it blows all over the place.
Oh, also, I noticed there's, like, Kira, you were, like, when he hit Noreen in the face with the snowball.
Oh, God.
You were upset with the snow.
Yeah.
So, no, it's funny because, so they went there in February to film this movie. And there was no snow. So they had to create every single bit of snow.
This makes more sense to
this
me.
This is where the 22
Yeah, because it was all ice. It was ice and slush. It was like slushy machine
stuff.
I mean,
a snowball hit you softly.
Yeah, like, unless it's old, but that wasn't, it was too clean to be that old.
Yeah.
Yeah, if it were all gray and partially black from like the road, then that would make
sense. Yeah, and
it
has like dog piss in it and like.
That's also kind of like a really great scene because it's really early. In the movie, and it kind of sets you up.
And he was trying to be playful. His intentions are like so.
That sums up the whole movie.
Yeah,
kind
he
of.
Had he like had this like person. Fantasy in his head of like a romantic comedy, and yet instead he was in a dark comedy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he says
he thought it was going to be that.
He actually says something about his entire life. He's like, my entire life, like I saw things that I wanted to be, and thought at some point I would be them, but then those moments passed, and slowly. More and more of those moments and people that I could be were reduced and reduced until I am who I am, which is the weatherman.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's really sad.
Yeah,
it is really
if you notice
sad,
that
but it's
scene,
also
in that scene, they do a really good job where he's like in a crowd.
He's
and
walking.
And the crowd becomes thinner and thinner. And then it's just
empty.
Him on an abandoned street in Chicago, which is the only time we ever see him walking down an abandoned street. In Chicago.
It's almost like it's the one time his mind is suddenly quiet.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's like, this is who I am.
Yeah, because he's coming to terms, like, the whole thing where...
It sounds depressing, but it's actually, like, helpful.
Well, no, because, like, the whole thing is a seemingly depressing event is what finally gives his father the opportunity to tell him what he needs to tell him about... Like, because I think a huge part of it is, like, his dad seems, like, kind of perturbed about everything that he's doing the entire time.
Right, in my distracted son who can't follow through on anything.
No.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
It's because there's always looking after. He basically explains, like, his entire, like,
you never
his whole
worrying.
Thing. Yeah, he's like, you never stop worrying about your kid. So he's not, like, mad at his kid. He's just, like, concerned, and he wants to make sure that he does well.
And
but
to
the
be
problem
fair,
is,
he
is
has
like
things
Nicolas
to be concerned
Cage
about.
Has so much trouble like connecting with people that he can't ever read it that way. He just reads it as a criticism or an advocacy.
Which it is though too, because his father is.
Nobody's quite doing it right in this movie. Like it's like there's no one that's blameless.
Yeah, but who does though in real
life?
Exactly,
it's wind. It blows all over the place.
Exactly. Yeah. So through all that, he finally realizes. That his life isn't out of control. It's just like, he just needs to like...
His life is just happening.
You know.
It's
life
just
is happening,
but he can have some control over it, which is what he learned through kind of archery and being able to focus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think we should do our ratings now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but also, so that last whole thing where he was... the whole monologue at the end about the people being reduced down to a single thing. Did any of you listen to Talking Heads? Mm-hmm. So they have that song on, I can't remember what album. It's called Seen and Not Seen. But that's like the basically the gist of that song. It's about somebody who like looks in magazines
mm-hmm. I had
and
dreams
sees people
or I see things.
That like, he wants yeah. to become, and like the sup, like the fantasy that the song has is like that. The way that you end up looking at it as an, the way that you physically look like as an adult is like a combination of like how you were gonna look, but also the person that you kind of tried to look. Like, and also a product of you trying to redirect sure. and change direction. It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, it is.
But it just reminded me of, like, that song. So it's a cool song.
I think, like, it really hit home for me because, yes, I did see a bunch of things that I admired and, like, just thought... Because he does say something specific in that. He says, like, that I thought I was going to be, but somehow, like... I never ended up in the situation or had the impetus to be these things. You know, it's a
yeah,
really
like
specific
said,
feeling. Like I had a lot of aspirations, but I never acted on them because I couldn't recognize when I even would have. You know, like yeah. he's kind of saying that,
and that's kind of
and that's
him
okay.
letting life kind of just. I think
it's just it's him saying like whatever he's been daydreaming about his entire life, he doesn't have to feel bad about not
right.
being.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not depressing at all, actually. That's freeing.
Right. It is said
in
a depressing
way. I mean, I thought I was
going to
be a cowboy, so.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to be a Ghostbuster.
Yeah. I'm still
I thought I was
saving the world every
store.
Day in my head.
I think I can.
But really, I just kind of work at the library and play video games and paint sometimes.
Yeah.
And I feed a lot of cats.
Ratings?
Oh,
I love
don't
it.
Don't let me start this time. Somebody else start.
Well, maybe someone who's seen this movie multiple times.
Aaron.
Out of five, what's your rating?
This movie, I give 5 out of 5.
Yeah.
I've always admired this film. From the first time I saw it and many subsequent viewings,
You've grown to like it more?
No, I think I've grown to see different angles of it. But it's always been, to me, just a really well-executed film. The writing is fantastic, clearly. It
mm-hmm.
lured some really talented actors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It allowed Nicolas Cage to show a side that no one else has... We haven't seen in any other movies that I know of.
What about American
Michael
Treasure?
Caine's fantastic.
Or
National
Treasure.
The Sorcerer's
Treasure.
Apprentice.
Yeah, no. But but also, like you were saying, there's a lot of non-verbal... gestures and facial expressions that speak volumes about these characters, and the understanding that the actors and the director and all of it, like there's clearly a something that works in this film,
mm-hmm.
and like there's nothing in here that's unnecessary. Everything, every shot, every scene, every line has meets an end in some way.
It really does. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
You're right. You're absolutely right,
Amanda.
I agree. Yeah, I would say 5. I really like this movie. I've watched it several times, and I'll watch it again.
So is it only Rokas and I who haven't seen it before?
I think so.
Okay.
I think that's why we picked it, but
yeah.
we didn't know that you... But I mean, we did, because
yeah.
we flew you here
yeah.
to...
Yeah, yeah,
right,
exactly.
Right, that's
we
right.
Knew,
yeah.
Expert.
The whole
right.
way.
Expert.
Yes.
American Airlines first class, not Spirit Airlines
right.
first class.
True.
Yeah, first class.
No, it's all just the same share.
It's a really
you
American
have to rotate
achievement.
It.
It's an American achievement.
First class Spirit, they just throw down a towel
yeah.
on your seat, and they're
yeah.
like, there you go.
First class
this
experience.
Towel is mostly clean.
True American Airlines.
Yeah.
It's a true...
It's supposed to be great.
It's an American achievement.
What do you think, Chuck?
So, between 1 and 5?
Between 1... Or 0 and 5.
Okay, I can give it a 0.
Well, yeah.
yeah.
I mean, if this were... Oh, God, and I can't remember the name of the goddamn movie now. The one where his head turns on, sets on fire.
Ghost Rider?
Ghost Rider. Like, Ghost Rider could get a 0.
No, well, I would give Ghost Rider like a...
Probably like a 5.5.
2.
Yeah.
I'd give it a 2.
I don't think I've actually seen it.
I've never seen
thing.
It, but I'll give it a 2.
Okay, well, so the next
the
movie we'll be watching is Ghost Rider.
Ghost Rider.
But also, what's your rating?
What do you mean?
What's your rating?
Oh, of this movie?
Yes.
When did we start doing ratings?
We've been doing
it
every
ago.
Time.
We've been every
every episode.
Wait, we do that. Wrap this up.
Every episode?
Yes. Most of them, yeah. Most
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, we read every, yeah.
Five.
Cool.
Wow.
Okay, Rokas.
No explanation?
Oh, I mean, I've seen this movie like a million times. I think it's a great movie. I think it's very, very pretty. I think it's really well written. I think the characters are really great. I think there's like a lot of depth in the characters. And once you, if you start looking at like the individual characters, like even though they seem like they're reacting to Nicolas Cage because he's like awful or not even awful, but whatever, they may not like him or have something against him. Like, it's not really that. Like, I don't think his father's like necessarily a bad dad and is disappointed in him. He's just like really bummed that he's dying or whatever, or he's coming to terms with that.
Sure.
But there's just a lot to unpack with this movie, and you start, and I think all of the major players in the movie do a very good job, even like Nicholas Holt, who's just like, just plays kind of the dopey kid, does a good job. Shelley does a great job.
Yeah.
Hope Davis is his ex-wife. Oh,
Hope Davis is
always
awesome.
Been one of my favorites.
Yeah, yeah. She's awesome in like every movie she does.
And if just imagining someone else cast in that role.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I don't know if I would have liked this movie as much.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I guess that's the same for
probably
any
about
of them.
Every.
I think
yeah.
the casting
yeah,
this
for
movie
every
is perfect.
Character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The casting.
She really makes the ex-wife character. She brings her to life, you know, and it's just like, whoa, you're missing the point.
You feel like you know that person.
Yeah. Yeah. She does a good job of like, getting like showing the years of like presumably at least 16 years of frustration that she has, with him and like, just like him and his inability to like, stay out of his own way or whatever.
And some, like, even the instances of confusion when he's like, I want to give this, like, another try. Oh, and it's like, what are you talking about?
What planet? Or
what planet are you on?
It's like, it was a sci-fi, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, I think we'll get back together when she clearly has a boyfriend that he knows she has. Like, it's like, and he thinks that they're going to marriage council together because she's going to
break up with the guy. I thought he was going to kill him at one point.
But, yeah, that one scene. Yeah.
But in his defense, he's never moved on.
True.
You don't get the sense that he's trying to get back in the game and date other women.
No. But he's also like not.
Because he's so.
He's not reading the room.
There's a scene. Yeah,
truly.
Okay, well, we're getting back into it.
I know
what's
we
your
are.
Rating,
you should just watch the movie. It's
watch
great.
The movie.
I would give this movie a 5 for a lot of the reasons that have already been mentioned. I think the most important to me was that this movie is so unflinchingly uncomfortable, like every step of the way.
Yeah.
And yet there's movies that we've all seen and that anyone listening can think of right now that were uncomfortable and made them want to like walk out of the room or maybe just turn it off and watch something else. Whereas this movie, despite being incredibly uncomfortable, I could not stop myself from continuing to watch it. I wanted to watch it.
There's
I wanted the next uncomfortable moment, not because it was uncomfortable, but because there was every character was three-dimensional. Every emotion and every interaction from these characters was realistic. It was something that I was like, yeah, that is what a person would do.
Mm-hmm.
That person would do that. And knowing that you get a sense of who these people are, and even just the conversations we've had about, you know, and slight debates about whether or not Dave's dad was an unflinching asshole, or if that's maybe just the perspective that Dave had you know, unreliable narrative or narrator and all of these other things. Like, there was such deliberate effort that went into every scene from the movie. It was just very well done. Even if dark comedies are like not your genre, or like you're an unintelligent person that can't think about things ever, this is a very well done movie.
Yeah,
very well done.
Kira, you're the last
Kira.
How many stars?
Two.
I'm gonna give it 5, but I don't feel like I have to add too much because everybody's already said stuff I was gonna say.
What was to you what stood out the most?
Just how real and relatable the characters were, and I liked the way it was shot. I don't like everything everybody's been saying. I don't think
I agreed with everything too, but like the uncomfortableness was what really drew me to it. You can repeat what other people said too.
You like the fashion show.
Yes.
The fashion show was pretty good. It was.
Yeah, it had one
bad.
It reminded me of Pretty Woman.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah. Wait, was his daughter not a prostitute?
Oh, no. My. Okay, oh podcast my is over.
It makes sense now.
No. Oh. Wow.
No. I mean, the cigarettes.
Yeah.
Only cigarettes.
I guess I got to watch this movie again.
Yeah.
Maybe I missed something.
Maybe we all missed something.
Well, I thought it was his son that was a prostitute.
No.
He clearly put out.
You're both.
He stole the man's wallet afterwards.
All right. Donate to our Patreon at patreon.com.
Please, I would like
home.
To. I would
get
like
Aaron
to fly
home.
Back.
Yeah,
we only had enough money for the one way flight.
We got to get him back to Chicago.
Yeah, he has to go to work eventually.
Yeah.
That is, you know, being an expert on Chicago job.
All right, next week, back to Paranormal Activity.
What are we on, number 8 or something?
Are we doing Japanese?
We're doing Japanese Paranormal Activity.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're doing Paranormal Activity, sequel. Tokyo Drift.
Yeah.
Tokyo Drift.
Okay, bye.
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 Bye. Bye.